The Blue Cliff Record, Case 13. Hario's Silver Bowl. The introduction. A cloud sits over the great plain. Snow covers the reed blossoms. They can hardly be distinguished from each other. As for coldness, it's colder than ice and snow. As for fineness, it's finer than rice powder. The deepest depth cannot be penetrated even by Buddha's eyes. The densest area cannot be measured even by aggressive demons. Let us put aside for a moment those who understand three when one is raised. What should be spoken in order to cut off the tongues of all people under heaven? Just say, who had the capacity to achieve this? I'll show you an example. Look. The case. A monk asked Hario, what is the Zen sect? Hario said, heaping up snow in a silver bowl. We should begin by understanding this image of snow in a silver bowl, in which the silver of the bowl is said to be exactly the color of snow. So when the bowl is completely filled, it's impossible to tell where the edges are. The snow and the bowl blur together, are indistinguishable. And yet, when you examine them closely, when you touch them, you see that they're two different substances. And in the introduction, we have the image of a cloud stretching completely over the earth so that it's completely covered with cloud, and the boundary between cloud and sky and earth blurs together. The way sometimes you see, I think, looking out at the horizon over the ocean, you can't quite tell where the sky ends and the ocean begins. The line of the horizon is completely erased. And the other image in the introduction is snow covering reed blossoms, which are just also supposed to be white. So the snow on the white blossoms all blends together and becomes indistinguishable. So what's being pointed to are two aspects of reality, which though distinct, come together to form one. And we could say they are not two and not one. A more contemporary image might be the duck rabbit illusion or drawing. Looked at one way, we see the rabbit. Looked at another way, we see the duck. It's one thing, yet we see it two different ways. And when we see it one way, we can't see it the other way. It's either wholly a duck to us or wholly a rabbit. When the perspective shifts, one side appears and the other disappears. I think one way of thinking about this koan is to see it as a kind of poetic illustration of ordinary mind is the way. Ordinary mind and way stand in relationship to each other, the way the snow does to the silver bowl. Our ordinary mind, what is that? Moment after moment, thoughts come and go. All these thoughts, in one sense, each is individual and unique. Taken together, they can just make a heap like snow and be indistinguishable. The silver bowl, the practice of the Dharma, the way. In a certain sense, it's this precious, finely wrought object, something that has taken great effort and great care to produce. And now we have a chance to hold it. And with that silver bowl in our possession, we have this container for all the thoughts and moments, all the dharmas pile up in this bowl and become indistinguishable from it, which is quite a remarkable thing. Because when we start out, our ordinary mind, the mind of thought and feeling, of preoccupation and lack and desire and attachment and loss, all that seems completely different, completely distinct from our image of the way, something that is whole and complete. And yet our practice brings these opposites together, such that at some point we see that they're not opposites at all, that they're one thing and have been that way all along. Choko taught by asking us to attend moment after moment to thought, labeling thought, repeating it to ourselves, seeing thought just as another momentary flash of thinking, rather than getting caught up in the content of the thought. Thinking, 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 one snowflake after another. If you look closely, it's very special. Just step back a little bit, just another snowflake, one more, one more, one more. And she taught us to do the same with our anxiety, with our anger, our resistance, with the pain or the tension in our body. Just to feel that, to breathe into that, allow it to be what it is. And doing that kind of practice over time allows us to be at home in our own mind. We no longer feel that our minds are contaminated by our thoughts, that our emotions are somehow something that need to be calmed or purged. The container of practice, whether you think of it as the blue sky or the silver bowl, is big enough to contain everything that we can put into it. Nothing has to be changed. Nothing has to be banished. We're not there to empty it or purify it. We simply can hold and contain it. And we let thought be thought, and feeling be feeling. And we see the ways that we've spent so much of our life avoiding and controlling, avoiding and controlling. Trying to push something aside, trying to fix it, trying to endlessly be different than what we are. And this practice teaches us to leave everything just as it is. We come with fantasies of great transformation. And here we are told to leave everything just as it is. When Joko taught this way, talking about thoughts and feelings in a way that was quite unusual for Zen practice, many people dismissed it as reducing Zen to psychology and said that what she was doing was just a form of therapy on the cushion. And she said, "That's not what I'm doing at all. All I do is teach the absolute." But what is the absolute? The absolute is just this, just this, just this. Regardless of its content, regardless of how it manifests, as a thought, as a feeling, as a pain, just leave it alone. Just feel it just as it is. Then we start seeing the emergence of the absolute in every moment, which doesn't have to mean anything very fancy or mystical or transcendental. It simply means we fully experience each moment of our life and allow it to be what it is. And when we do that, nothing is hidden, nothing is lacking, and we're just experiencing our life. Now, I think when we misunderstand what Joko was pointing at, we turn her practice of labeling into yet another thing we can do well or badly, and we turn it into a project of trying to make sure we label each thought, we pay the correct attention to our body or our tensions in our body. And then I think what we end up with is something like shoveling snow in a blizzard. You know, all this stuff is coming at us constantly. And we turn our practice into something that's supposed to be dealing with it, right? And when we think that way, we never catch up. Everything just comes at us too quickly, too much. We feel like we're supposed to be getting control of our minds by labeling our thoughts or doing some other kind of practice. But then we're just always a day late and a dollar short. And our practice, or what we're calling our practice, is just caught up in another one of our endless curative fantasies of self-improvement or control. And it may be that we inevitably start out that way and can't help but think of practice like that until something in us just gives up and allows ourselves to surrender to the moment, to let go of the control, Just let the snow slowly fill up the bowl. I think as we start, we inevitably have this dichotomy in our mind between the ordinariness of the snow and the preciousness of the bowl. And it's very easy to get stuck on one side of that equation or the other. Certainly, we can get preoccupied with this practice as something special and precious, the silver bowl that requires so much meticulous handicraft and care. We treat it like a special, precious object that enhances us as our possession. And on the other hand, we can treat practice as something so ordinary that we just sit and allow ourselves to think or daydream. And we feel that if we just sit and get used to what all the things that our mind can do, we get more or less comfortable with the fact that we're going to get angry, that sometimes we're going to be restless or anxious or physically uncomfortable. And we learn to take these things in our stride. We're no longer afraid of our mind as it is. We get comfortable with it. And there we use the container of practice as a sort of ordinary kind of bowl. And we've learned to contain what comes up for us in a way that makes it less overwhelming, frightening. We're not running from our own mind. We're at home with in our life. And at that level, practice is very beneficial and in a sense very ordinary. And I think probably that level of disciplined practice is what's most important and most transformative for most of us throughout our years of practice. This simple discipline of showing up and through long sitting, becoming at home in our bodies, in our minds. I think that may be the most important thing most people get out of this practice. But it's not all there is to it. The bowl really is made of silver, and it is precious. And it is inseparable from our moment-to-moment experience. We learn not just to contain our experience moment to moment, but to cherish it, to experience our life with joy and reverence, to see that really all these moments are not just bearable, but in some sense, perfect and miraculous. Really, nothing is lacking Nothing is hidden. When we taste that, then we have a taste of Zen.